Now, last time I gave a sermon on the Exodus, as you might have gathered, I didn't finish that sermon. I gave you a long list of questions, filled up the screen with questions, as a matter of fact, and we got into some of them. One thing I wanted to, I pointed out is this: there's a lot of disagreement about the Exodus. And why is that? Well, we have basically three sources of information. The biblical record, the archaeological record, and the historical record. Now, as far as everybody in this room is concerned, the gold standard is the biblical record. Yeah, that's it. Archaeology, historical records, they're very secondary. But to the experts, and I put that in quotes, the experts, which are the historians, the archaeologists, the scientists that study these sorts of things, they kind of look at the historical record, archaeology, and biblical record in that order. In other words, they flip it. And the biblical record is there's a lot of myths and stuff in the Bible, and who knows how accurate that is. But the historical record, those historians, they don't ever make a mistake, you know, that kind of mentality. And so that's one of the big problems, is they don't really take the Bible for what it says. And we do. Now, in addition to that, there's one big assumption that practically everybody makes. Now, I take that back. One huge, gigantic assumption that practically everybody makes looking back at things like the Exodus. Now, to explain it, I'm going to ask you two questions. But the first question is, how many of you have ever been to Israel? Raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Did I miss it? Anyway, about 9 or 10 people here have been to Israel. Okay, the second question is directed to you. And I'll ask for a show of hand again. How many of you, based on your experience in being in Israel, walking around through the land, probably most likely most of you from Galilee down to Jerusalem, through the Jordan Valley, you probably saw lots of this stuff. How many of you would classify what you saw as the land of milk and honey? How many would classify it as the land of milk and honey? I don't see any hands. And that's the big assumption that most people make. That is, the geology and the environmental conditions from 33,500 years ago are the same as they are today. They haven't changed. And obviously, in several cases, God told Moses he was sending the Israelites out of Egypt into the land of milk and honey. And we have certain descriptions of that when the spies went in, and it was indeed a very different time. Things were green. Anybody see any green when you were in Israel? Every now and then, you'd see a little spot of green where they watered it a lot and produced some grass. But there's not much green in Israel now. Apparently, there was a lot of green 3,500 years ago. And so things were different. So if we operate on the sole basis of what we see now is what Moses saw, or the Israelites saw, rather, when they finally came into Canaan, and what Moses heard from God about the promised land. Very different at that time. So you have to take that into account whenever you're looking at anything about ancient Israel. Things were different then. Now, I've given you this list of questions that we started answering last time. Why were the Israelites in slavery? I showed you several scriptures that explained it very simply. Before they went into slavery, they started turning to the gods of Egypt. And that was God's punishment for that. We talked about the debate about natural explanations for miracles. This is what the, quote again, experts love, because they don't believe in miracles. They're materialist. And so they want to desperately explain anything described in the Bible, not as a miracle, but as a natural occurring phenomena that just happened to occur at the right moment. I've heard quotes from archaeologists that say, the miracle is not in the sea parting or this happening or the locusts or anything. It's in the timing of it. It was a natural phenomenon, and it just happened just at the right time. You know, so that's the mentality, and that's why there's this big debate about whether these were, a lot of these things were really miracles or just natural phenomena. And we also showed you some quotes where some religious leaders, including Jewish leaders, have said, no, there was no Exodus. Not anything like what the Bible describes. Maybe 1,500 or so, a couple thousand people, maybe that many went out. But it didn't happen like that. You know, it was a, just kind of a storytelling kind of thing. Storybook is what the early part of the Bible is. That's the attitude that they take. And then we did talk about a date for the Exodus. I told you and showed you some numbers that puts it at around 1447 B.C. That depends on how accurately we can pin down Solomon's reign, as I mentioned to you then. I noticed if you watch Mr. Giese's first FI online about the book of Joshua, he put it at 1445. So he and I will have to butt heads about that later. The point is, he may be right. And it may have been 1449, because there's a little bit of question of exactly when Solomon's reign was. So it depends on which experts you look at and the reasoning behind what they come up with, exactly what date you might come up with. But we can be pretty sure that it was mid-1400s B.C., right around the midway point. And so we talked about that. Then we talked about this thing about the city of Ramses and Ramses himself. Now, Ramses reigned several hundred years after the Exodus. And so so he wasn't around during the Exodus. And neither was the city of Ramses. There were cities there. And a palace was later built there. But the conclusion is that the people that put the final version of the Old Testament together were doing that like in the 6th century or so, somewhere, you know, a few hundred years before Christ. They kind of canonized it, you might say. And at that point, everybody knew where Ramses was. And if they'd said Avaris, which is one of the cities that archaeology has recently showed, a lot of Hebrews live there, nobody would know what they were talking about. And so so this thing about Ramses was just a convenient editing thing describing the area as they knew it at the time they codified the Bible. All right, so in, that brings us down to how many, the last thing I talked about, how many Hebrews departed the Exodus. And I gave you as an amendment, minimum, and I kind of showed you how I came about calculating that. At least 2.4 million, more than likely about 2.8 million, could well have been over 3 million, but certainly well up into the 2 millions as a minimum. And so that's where we stopped last time. And so what today I want to look at these next four questions here. Exactly where is the Red Sea? Doesn't everybody know where the Red Sea is? Turns out they don't. And where is Horeb and Mount Sinai? Doesn't everybody know where Mount Sinai? Anybody been to Mount Sinai here when you went on some of your travels? Nobody? Ah, way back in the back. Two. yeah, so we have someone that knows exactly where Mount Sinai is. She thinks. Okay, we will discuss that. And then we're going to talk about two proposed paths that the Israelites took. I'm going to talk about two today, and next Sabbath I'll be speaking again, the last holy day, and I'll talk about two more. And we'll delve even further into the Exodus at that time. But we'll look at two of those today. But let's begin with the Red Sea. Now, here's the problem. Yeah, my marker's showing there. Here's the Red Sea. Here's the Gulf of Suez, and here's the Gulf of Aqaba. Now, most people would say, well, it's really all part of the Red Sea, kind of. But the question is, what did they call it back then? What was identified as the Red Sea back then? We kind of need to know that because the Israelites crossed the Red Sea, and it'd be nice to kind of know which Red Sea they were talking about in the Bible when it says they crossed the Red Sea. So that's what we want to look at, and that said, we're going to look at a crossing up here near Goshen, which a lot of the experts really like this one. But it doesn't even cross the Red Sea. It crosses a bunch of swampy lakes up near the land of Goshen. And then we're going to look at one that crosses down here at the mouth of the Gulf of Aqaba. Now, obviously, there are some others that we'll talk about, as I said, next time. We're going to look at those two today. But let's go back. My title, The Miracle of the Exodus, Part 2. But let's look at this thing about where is the Red Sea. In particular, where is the Red Sea that the Bible was talking about? Which Red Sea was that? Now, if you look up Red Sea, you'll find that it's translated from the Hebrew as Yam Suf. Yam Suf. And then if you look up each of the words, Yam, which is a Strong's number, is 3220, it means sea, large body of water, sometimes a large river. So it's a big body of water. It's basically what sea generally means. Now, if you look up Suf, which is Strong's 5488, what Strong says, probably Egyptian, a reed, red, or weed. It can mean one of those three things. That's kind of a big range there of things. From red to a reed. But when you look at it in more detail, and notice it says probably Egyptian. Since when did the Hebrews start writing in Egypt, Egyptian language? They wrote in Hebrew. So I kind of question it when you hear that. But then you start looking at the places where Yam Suf appears. And there's 20 appearances, and by appearances I mean occasions where the Red Sea, Yam Suf, is referred to. Now, sometimes it's mentioned twice in the same sentence, obviously talking about the same thing. Now, if you actually look at it, there's actually 25 specific times Yam Suf appears and is translated Red Sea. But several of those is used twice in the same sentence, so it's really only 20 separate occasions. But anyway, also two in the New Testament, but that's in Greek, so that's a little different issue. But how many of these in the Old Testament, Yam Suf, specifically are identified as the Gulf of Suez? Zero. How many are specifically identified as the Gulf of Aqaba? 10. Now, there's another 15 that are inconclusive. It says the Red Sea, Yam Suf, but it does, from the context, you don't really know what Yam Suf they're talking about. Are they talking about the Gulf of Suez? Are they talking about the Gulf of Aqaba? Generally, they are not talking about the Red Sea, that big part. They're talking about one of those two fingers. So, here's the problem then. And I'm going to list several problems as we go through different things here. The evidence of which the Israelites, of the sea which the Israelites crossed. That's the problem. We need some evidence to figure out which sea the Israelites crossed. And, there's a lot of debate about this issue. All right. Let me show you a few of the typical verses that use Yam Suf. Exodus 15:4. Pharaoh's chariots and his army he has cast into the sea. His chosen captains also are drowned in the Red Sea. Yam Suf. Okay. Now, but that doesn't really tell us much about where it is. You look at the context, we don't get much. Numbers 33, verses 10 and 11. They moved from Elam and camped by the Red Sea. They moved from the Red Sea and camped in the wilderness of Sin. Aha! Now we've got it, because we know it's near Elam and the wilderness of Sin. There's one little minor problem there. Nobody knows where Elam is. There's no historical record. There's no archaeological record. Elam is mentioned, but nobody knows where it is. Likewise, nobody knows exactly what they mean when they say, when the Bible says wilderness of Sin. There's no sign. Maybe I should ask Lynn, did you see a sign that said wilderness of Sin, turn left here? they don't know. All right, look at Deuteronomy 1, verse 40. But as for you, turn and take your journey into the wilderness by the way of the Red Sea, Yam Suf. Okay, now, this one, in Deuteronomy 1:40, this is the context of this one, is that Israel was getting ready to go into the promised land, and they said, nah, they're too mean over there. We're not going. Okay. And so God said, okay, turn around, go back into the wilderness by the way of the Red Sea. Now remember, they're up right at Canaan. They turned around. I'll show you a map in just a second, but let me show you this scripture first. Exodus 10:19, and the Lord turned a very strong west wind, which took the locusts away from and blew them into the Red Sea, Yam Suf. There remained not one locust in all the territory of Egypt. All right, let me bring up this map here again. All right, now, Egypt at that time was what's referred to as Lower Egypt. The kingdom was Lower Egypt, lower meaning where the Nile River flows into the Mediterranean Sea. And so is this area right in here? Now, if you have this, when they say west wind, that means it's coming out of the west, blowing east. That means it's blowing across this way. And if it was truly, totally just a west wind, it would probably miss both of these. But the prevailing winds tend to be slightly out of the north as well as the west. And so they tend to move more diagonally this way. But it almost have to be out of the north to blow it into the Gulf of Suez. A slightly diagonal would catch the Gulf of Aqaba. Plus, many argue that the Gulf of Suez is part of Egypt. This is Egypt-claimed territory. Now, there's a lot of debate. Different times, different people tried to claim different things. But from what I've read, Egyptians thought this belonged to them. But everything was pushed out. Not one was left in the area of Egypt. So this scripture kind of suggests that maybe the Gulf of Aqaba is the Red Sea. And likewise, in the previous Deuteronomy 1 that I was reading, they're up here getting ready to go into the land of Canaan. They chicken out. Do they come back here and in this area, or do they come all the way back over here? Seems logical. That's probably referring to the Gulf of Aqaba when they said, go back by way of the Red Sea. And that phrase is used several times, by way of the Red Sea. Matter of fact, when they're coming out of Egypt, it's used they went by way of the Red Sea. All right, so Let's look at this. Exodus 23 and verse 31. I will set your bounds from the Red Sea, Yam Suf, to the Sea of Philistia, and from the desert to the river, referring to Euphrates, for I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you shall drive them out before you. Now, here I've shown you this map, and this outline is the largest expansion of Israel, and it was under King Solomon's rule. And it went from the Red Sea to the Mediterranean Sea, the Sea of the Philistines. And then it went from the desert to the Euphrates. Now, this clearly seems to be referring to, again, the Gulf of Aqaba as the Red Sea. Now, there is a river here, but it's mostly a dry riverbed now. It's called the Brook of the Nile. Only in the rainy season does water flow into it. Back then, it was probably more of a real river. And I mention that because there's this Solomon's expansion is a fulfillment of Genesis 5:18. On the same day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants, I have given you this land from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates. Now, some would say, well, that's the Nile. But there was also this other river of Egypt. And it's more likely that, because that's as far as the Israelites ever expanded. They didn't expand to the Nile. All right, so let's look at 1 Kings 9:26. King Solomon also built a fleet of ships at Ezion Geber, which is near Elath on the shore of the Red Sea, Yam Suf, in the land of Edom. Okay, so here's Edom right over here, and here's Elath, and here's where he had his ships, in the Gulf of Aqaba. Then Jeremiah 49, verse 21, the earth shakes at the noise of their fall, at the city, at the cry, its noise is heard at the Red Sea, Yam Suf. Now, the verse before that says what he's talking about. I didn't show it here, but in verse 20 of Jeremiah 49, therefore hear the counsel of the Lord that he has taken against Edom. So he's talking about Edom here and the fall of Edom, and it was heard all the way to the Red Sea. Again, suggests the Gulf of Aqaba. So the conclusion, the Bible refers to the Gulf of Aqaba as the Red Sea. It's pretty clear. But it is inconclusive whether it refers to the Gulf of Suez as the Red Sea. We just don't, the context doesn't identify the Gulf of Suez. All right, but what about the reed business? Where does that come from? Well, it comes from really, well, two passages. In Exodus 2 and verse 5, then the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, and her maidens walked along the riverside, and when she saw the ark among the reeds, she sent her maid to get it. And the word suf is used there. Now, it also is used in Exodus 2:3. I didn't show that one up, but it's the same discussion here, discussing Moses being put in the little ark and floated down the Nile River to and discovered by the Pharaoh's daughter. So it's translated here as reeds, and there's one other place that is translated that way, and that is in, and I didn't show the scripture, but I'll just give it to you, Isaiah 19:6. It uses the phrase reeds and rushes. Now, reeds in Isaiah 19:6 is the Hebrew word is kana, not suf. But rushes is translated suf, reeds and rushes. Now, that's the only places where suf is not Red Sea. So a little questionable there about what all that means, but it's a very limited place that where Suf is used for anything other than the Red Sea. So, conclusions. First, the Bible evidence is clear that the Gulf of Aqaba is referred to as the Red Sea. It's inconclusive as whether the Gulf of Suez is referred to as the Red Sea. And there's no evidence that the shallow lakes near Goshen are referred to as the Red Sea. None whatsoever. But yet some people think that's where the crossing was. All right, so let's go to where Mount Sinai is. Now, what we find is there's two terms that's used for the mountain of God. Mount Horeb, Exodus 33:6. So the children of Israel stripped themselves of their ornaments by Mount Horeb. Now, this is when they were getting ready to really build the tabernacle and decorate it and so forth. And so they were making a contribution. So this was near the mountain of God that they were doing this. It's before they left from the mountain of God and began to work their way towards Canaan. And so clearly Mount Horeb is being referred to as the mountain of God. Now, Mount Sinai, look at Exodus 24:13, first of all. Verse 13, so Moses arose with his assistant Joshua, and Moses went up to the mountain of God. Then Moses went, so they definitely at the mountain of God, here's what I'm pointing out in verse 13. And so we go to verse 15. Then Moses went up into the mountain, and a cloud covered the mountain. And verse 16, and now the glory of the Lord rested on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days. And on the seventh day, he called to Moses out of the midst of the cloud. So here we see Mount Horeb referred to as the mountain of God, Mount Sinai, the term Sinai referred to as the mountain of God, which is another problem, the location of the mountain of God. Where is that thing? Well, let's look. Now, Mount Sinai is referred to 26 times. The wilderness of Sinai is referred to 12 times. Horeb is referred to 17 times. Mount Horeb is referred to 3 times. They sound almost interchangeable, don't they? Look at Deuteronomy 4, verse 15. Take careful heed to yourselves, for you saw no form when the Lord spoke to you at Horeb out of the midst of the fire. So here, Horeb is being used as the mountain of God. Or Deuteronomy 18, verse 16. According to all you desired of the Lord your God in Horeb in the day of the assembly, saying, let me not hear again the voice of the Lord my God, nor let me see the great fire any more, lest I die. Well, you know that story. You go up and talk to him. I'm not going up there. This is scary. Well, this was at Horeb. Now, the location apparently was known in Elijah's time, because we see in 1 Kings 19:8, so he arose and ate and drank, and he went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights as far as Horeb, the mountain of God. So it very clearly says Horeb is the mountain of God. So what's going on here? Now, Horeb is used primarily in Deuteronomy. Sinai is used primarily in Exodus, although there's sometimes it's used in both. But if you look up Sinai in Strong's, look for the definition Sinai, it says of uncertain derivation, a mountain in Arabia. Okay, so that's what Strong's has to say about Sinai. Now, the traditional Mount Sinai is located in the southern Sinai Peninsula. Sinai, as I said, is used primarily in the book of Exodus. The meaning of Sinai is unknown. According to Strong's, it's of uncertain derivation, a mountain in Arabia. And the Jewish Encyclopedia has something interesting to say here. The peninsula was not called Sinai in Josephus' time or earlier, but gained its name by tradition because Christians began identifying it as the location of the mountain of God. Now, which Christians rose up around 3rd, 4th century? The pseudo-Christians, Christians of the Roman Empire. So I always get suspicious when the Catholic Church starts telling us where the mountain of God might be. All right, but the scriptures do not suggest that Sinai is located in the southern Sinai Peninsula. We don't get any idea that the mountain of God is located in the Sinai Peninsula. It's called Mount Sinai, but we don't know where it is. So what's going on here? Well, let me show you this. Here's the traditional Mount Sinai right down here. And over here in Midian, some people make a case, and I'm going to show you why they make this case. The mountain of God's over here. And they even have a location. It's called Mount Laws, L-A-W-Z. And it's over here in this mountain range here. Now, let me say this right up front. Whether we're talking about the traditional Mount Sinai, whether we're talking about this Mount Laws, I have seen no evidence in the Bible, in archaeology, in historical record that truly identifies a specific mountain as the mountain of God. It's not there. What I have seen is some pretty specific scriptures that tell us the general area where the mountain of God was located, but not where that mountain specifically was or and still is, for that matter. All right, so you know, it raised the question here. I'm showing the location of the two, Mount Sinai, Mount Laws, just for discussion purposes here. Mount Laws is about 7,500 feet high. Mount Sinai is about 850. Also, sometimes there's two mountain peaks right together there, Mount Catherine and Mount Musa, Mount Moses. So one of those, they believe, is the traditional Mount Sinai, but they don't say which, really. But they're two kind of almost side by side. But do we really care? You know, is it that big a deal? Isn't it, what counts is what went on there? But when we're talking about the miracles of the Exodus, it does make a difference in the magnitude of the miracles. And it is kind of nice to know where we're really talking about. If we're going to talk about, well, where did these Israelites actually go? Where were they led? And does it make any sense, some of these routes? All right, so just to give you some idea of distances, to Mount Sinai is 220 miles, about 250 miles as the quail fly, to Mount Laws, and up to the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, about 200 miles. All right. Now, I'm going to use Google Maps, Google Earth, and zero in on, can you see the little green? It's kind of hard to see on my screen. Somewhere right in here is a little green dot. Does it show up better there? Anyway, let me zoom in some. This is the area of southern Sinai. Ah, there it is. You can see it here. We've zoomed in. This is a satellite view. Let's zoom in. Well, I didn't zoom in any further. Around the 4th, 5th century, Catholics built a monastery here at presumably the foot of Mount Sinai. So this is the monastery looking at a backdrop of the traditional Mount Sinai. All right, now go back to my Google Maps here. And this this is a view of the top of Mount Sinai, the traditional Mount Sinai. And what I'm going to do here is we're going to fly around it. So I'm going to put it in motion. There it goes. You can see there's like a little miniature valley up here in the top of this thing. And we're going around it. You can see here's down here is a lower section. And as we come around to this side here, you can see this is really down at the base in this area right here. If this was the true Mount Sinai, then more than likely, let me get it a little bit further, more than likely this was the area where all the Israelites were gathered, somewhere down in this area here. but this is the traditional Mount Sinai. Now, is that the true Mount Sinai? Well, I'll let you decide a little bit later. Whoops, let's go on here. All right, now, Mount Horeb. Let's look at this. Exodus 3 and verse 1. Okay, now, Moses killed the Egyptian, fled Egypt, spent the next 40 years in Midian. Exodus 3, verse 1. Now, Moses was tending the flocks of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the back of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. Now, this seems to me to be a pretty clear statement that the mountain of God was in Midian. And Midian, but every historian that I have seen places Midian east of the Gulf of Aqaba, not in the Sinai Peninsula, but on the other side of the Gulf of Aqaba. Okay, so what was he doing up in the lower in the mountains to start with? Oh, he was just tending sheep. And he took them up there, get some better pasture land in the lower reaches of the mountain as compared to the desert, which is probably getting hot and drying out and so forth. And so he takes them up to get some food, sees the burning bush. Then in Exodus 4, verse 18, so Moses went and returned to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, please let me go and return to my brethren who are in Egypt and see whether they're still alive. And Jethro said to Moses, go in peace. Now the Lord said to Moses in Midian, they're in Midian, go, return to Egypt, for all the men you saw who sought your life are dead. Then Moses took his wife and his sons and set them on a donkey, and they returned to the land of Egypt. So he took his family with him, set off to the land of Egypt. All right, let's skip ahead to he's back. Exodus 18, beginning in verse 1. He's back in Midian. He's crossed the Red Sea. They come back. They're in Midian. And Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard all that that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, that the Lord had brought them out of Egypt. So they show back up in Midian again. Now, where did Jethro hear all this? Did he know anything about all this? Somebody had to tell him. Well, verse 2, then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he had sent her back with her two sons. Now, logically, what seems to have happened here, they get back to Midian. Moses got two million or so people, stiff-necked people to deal with. The most likely thing would be, he says, go visit your father, let him see the grandchildren, and I'm going to take care of these stiff-necked Israelites in the meantime. And so they go. It's not far away. They're in Midian. Then Jethro comes back in verse 5. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his son, with his sons and his wife to Moses in the wilderness where he was encamped at the mountain of God. So they're encamped at the mountain of God. They're in Midian. I don't know. Maybe I'm missing something here. But it kind of sounds like the mountain of God is east of the Gulf of Aqaba. Am I missing something here? Now, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe when Moses was tending those sheep, maybe he said, well, boy, I'm not getting much. The sheep just aren't getting enough food here. I think what I'll do is I'll drive them down to the Gulf of Aqaba. Not a cattle drive, a sheep drive. And I'm going to drive them across the Gulf of Aqaba. Do sheep even swim? So here's this herd of sheep swimming across the Gulf of Aqaba. Then he goes down to Mount Sinai, sees the burning bush, then goes back. The sheep have to swim back across and back to Midian. The logic of this, I just don't get it. It seems like to me the mountain of God's in Midian. Now, I guess it's possible that Moses could have driven the sheep all the way around Elath down here. But again, I don't see the logic of that. Or maybe he put them all on boats and floated them across. But, you know, I'm getting carried away here. You know, it just doesn't fit from these descriptions that the mountain of God was in the lower Sinai Peninsula. Now, there's one New Testament scripture that tells us where it is. Just breaking into a sentence because it's talking about something. This is just kind of an aside here that Paul is writing in Galatians 4, 24 and 25. For these are the two covenants, the one from the Mount Sinai, which gives birth to bondage, which is Hagar. For this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia. Now, generally, this is considered Arabia, this area here. Here's Midian, Edom, Moab, Ammon, Philistia, and scattered also in here are the Amalekites. They kind of roam around some. Okay? But this area here is not usually considered Arabia. Now, some would argue, yeah, it was back then. Well, okay. Maybe so. Maybe not. But this scripture seems to be applying it was in Arabia. Now, I mentioned Mount Laws. Some people have made a case that that's the mountain of God. And it is in what was then Midian, now Saudi Arabia. You know, could Sinai be a word like Ramses that was just inserted at some point along the way by editors of the Bible? Well, maybe so. All right, but let's look at this area, this mountain range here. Again, I'm having trouble seeing it on my computer. I think that little green dot somewhere right in there. But we're going to zoom into it further. And let's zoom into it some more. All right, now we're getting in fairly close here. And then one more shot. Again, it doesn't look that much different from the traditional Mount Sinai. Some peaks, a little valley in between, that sort of thing. Now let's fly around this one. Now here's an upper level area here. By the way, this area is much more rugged, it looks like, than the traditional Sinai. And you see way down here is this area. If this is it, the Israelites were probably down in some area there, or perhaps over in this area here. But it's pretty rugged. But there's a lot of mountains that look very similar to these. These happen to be the tallest in the Midian side and the tallest on the Sinai side. And so, is that important? Well, kind of. The one source that tells us something about the height of the mountain of God is Josephus. He says it's the tallest mountain. The tallest mountain. How would he know? How would anybody know what the tallest mountain was at that time? My initial training was as a civil engineer. I went to graduate school, became a structural engineer. Civil engineers do surveying, and they measure land, and they measure the heights of things. And I do not think there was any chance in the world that anybody at that time had the surveying knowledge to figure out how high Mount Sinai was, wherever it was. Now, it may have looked like the highest one, but just eyeballing it. But, you know, there's a lot of tall mountains in a range. So I wouldn't put much confidence in Josephus in this case. All right, let's... Now, so what we really don't have any reference for specific mountains. You know, here was Mount Sinai over here in this area. Then we have Mount Laws here. Now, there's another mountain nearby Mount Laws. It's a little bit south of it. And some people like this one. It's Mount Magla. And they like it because it's black on the top. Obviously, that must be the mountain because it's burned. All the fire and lightning when God was there left it burned. But some geologists have said, no, that's just a natural occurring type of rock that this mountain happens to be made of. So, but and then there's one way up here, near, on the just inside Jordan, as a matter of fact, modern-day Jordan, Mount Ad-Dami. And that might be it. We don't know the specific mountain. But it looks like to me it was in the Median side of the Gulf of Aqaba. Now, in the early 70s, Dr. Herman Hay went to Israel, went to the traditional Mount Sinai. And that's a picture of him on that camel. And he found this rock here. And it had some striations on it. And he concluded, this is probably the rock where the water came out of. Yeah, well, striations from water 3,500 years later, well, I don't know. I think it's a little questionable. But then if you go over near Mount Laws, here's another rock, the Split Rock. This is the rock where the water came out of. You can find things like that, but there's really no real evidence of where the mountain actually was. We can only talk about maybe the general area that the mountain was located in. So our conclusions. Horeb and Sinai appear to be used interchangeably in the Bible. There's no strong biblical evidence that the Exodus Mountain of God... there is strong biblical evidence that the mountain of God was in Midian. However, there are plenty of mountains in Midian, and God could have selected from a large number of possibilities. Sinai may not have been coined until the 3rd or 4th century, that term, Sinai. The location of the southern Sinai Peninsula is primarily a pseudo-Christian tradition, with little or no Bible support as to that being the mountain of God. But the possibility cannot be ruled out that maybe there was more than one mountain of God. But I don't think so. The only basis for choosing these specific mountains is Josephus, as I mentioned, the tallest mountain in the area. All right. So did the Israelites cross the Red Sea near Goshen? Let's look at the logic of a couple of these crossings here to wrap up the sermon today. Did they cross near Goshen? Now, this brings up a problem. We need a route that's consistent with the Bible, and that's a problem when we look at this alternative. Here's the idea. The idea is, here's Ramses. They took off from Ramses to Succoth, but nobody knows where Succoth is. Then they headed up this way. This is the way of the Philistines. And so they headed up to this way, and then they ran into the swamp, hit the swamp. Swamp parted. Egyptians came behind. They went through. The swamp cut, buried them and killed them. And then they turned down this way and headed towards Mount Sinai. So that's the theory. Now, look at Exodus 13:17. Then it came to pass, when Pharaoh had let the people go, that God did not lead them by the way of the land of Philistines. Whoops! He didn't lead them that way. But this theory says, oh, yes, he did. And then they turned, see? Although that was near, for God said, lest the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. Okay, so see, we've got a problem right there. Then we've got a problem of the evidence for the location of key biblical cities. Look at Exodus 14, verses 2 through 4. Speak to the children of Israel that they turn and camp before Pahaharoth, between Migdol and the sea, opposite Baal Zephon. You shall camp before it by the sea, for the Pharaoh will say to the children of Israel, they are bewildered by the land, the wilderness has closed them in. Then I will harden Pharaoh's heart, so I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over his army, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. And they did so. Okay, now, here's the problem. Again, I'll come back to this map. You see, they've shown Baal Zephor over here. They're showing Migdol here, Pahaharoth somewhere in there. And nobody knows where they are. There's no evidence that they were there. They just made up these locations to fit that scripture and fit their idea of the plan. And here's another thing. Notice where this is. It's right beside Goshen. They lived in Goshen for hundreds of years. They probably fished in these lakes, these shallow lakes. They probably hunted in these shallow lakes. They were lost and confused when they took one step east out of Goshen. No, logic just doesn't fit that idea. It just doesn't work. All right, so but taking this, so they come out, they cross the Red Sea almost immediately, although this isn't the Red Sea. That's another big question. These are some swampy lakes. They come down here, and then they circle up and go into Canaan, or go to Canaan. Now, one reason they like this route, because, again, our friend Josephus says that they crossed the Red Sea 3 days after they left Egypt. That's what Josephus says. So it had to be right there. That's the argument. I don't necessarily believe Josephus, and I don't think the Bible supports that either. But anyway, that's one of the reasons that they give for why this is the proper crossing. Now, let's talk about time. Once they crossed, they crossed almost immediately, just a few days by this theory. They crossed. Then they have to go down to the traditional Mount Sinai. How long would it take them? Cattle drive, did some research here. Cattle drive, about 1.5 miles an hour if you were driving cattle. And they had lots of livestock. 10 hours a day, that would be about 15 miles a day. If you're doing a 12-hour day, and that's a pretty long day for animals, 18 miles a day. Covered wagons can go about 2 miles an hour. They might have had some wagons, but I'll just give you some numbers on that. If you're going at 2 miles an hour, then you're talking about 20 miles a day for 10-hour days, and for 12-hour days, you're talking about 24 miles a day. Now, here's the thing. From Ramses or Avaris, as we talked about last time, to Mount Sinai is about 250 miles. All right, now, they got to Sinai, we think. We don't know for sure. God doesn't say, I'm giving these Ten Commandments and it's going to be on Pentecost. Bible doesn't say that. But it's right around that time, and we believe it was. But at least it was right around that time. And so we're talking about, so that's about 50 days, they crossed almost immediately. That's 50 days, roughly, to get down to the Red Sea, Mount Sinai. Well, that can be a little bit of a problem here, because if you subtract out Sabbaths out of those 50, they didn't travel on the Sabbath, then there's maybe 42 days, give or take a few, of travel time. Now, if you divide 42 days into 250 miles, you come up with they had to travel about 6 miles a day. Now, 6 miles a day For a 12-hour day, that would mean you'd be traveling about a half mile an hour. For an 8-hour day, you'd be traveling about three-quarters of a mile an hour. Now, how far is three-quarters of a mile? Do you think you could travel, even with your flocks, three-quarters of a mile in an hour? Well, if you go out the door here, go down to the street, and that's your starting point, swing a right, go down to 190, swing a left, walk down to the interstate. You've gone three-quarters of a mile. Now, don't try this at home. That's assuming no traffic, okay? Just walk down. Could you walk that in an hour? I dare say that probably Miss Mary Rice, with her sore foot, could probably hop down there in an hour. Now, that's not very far to go, and that's very slow, 6 miles a day. And so that's a problem with this route. They're going slow, and they're trying to get away from Egypt. So that doesn't fit too well. So that's another problem there. And then there's the time for Pharaoh to marshal his army. Probably 10%, somewhere between 5 and 10% of Pharaoh's army was killed, his firstborns. Not just the soldiers, but the leaders. And then everybody's burying their dead. I don't care much about the Israelites. They got a bigger problem. Notice Numbers 33, verse 3 through 4. They departed from Ramses in the first month, on the 15th day of the first month, on the day after the Passover. The children of Israel went out with boldness in the sight of the Egyptians, for the Egyptians were burying their firstborn, whom the Lord had killed among them. And also on their gods, the Lord had executed judgments. They were in no conditions to take off right immediately right after the all this happened to them. They needed some time to recover, to reorganize their army. This doesn't leave them a whole lot of time. So that's another question. And then we come to problem number six here, the water depth. Are they consistent with the biblical narrative? Isaiah 51, verse 11. Are you not the one who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep, that made the depths of the sea a road for the redeemed to cross over? Now, these shallow lakes are not really lakes. They're swamps. Matter of fact, of all the people in the world that understand the land of Goshen, South Louisiana should. Yeah, just think of the Nile River as the Mississippi River, that long thing sticking out the bottom end of Louisiana as, you know, where did it come from? Well, from overflowing of the Mississippi River over the ages. Where did the Goshen come from? The overflow of the Nile River over the ages. Same thing, flat, flat, flat. Shallow lakes, that sort of thing. So that's what we're talking about here. Probably no deeper than about 3 feet. You know, maybe thigh level, if you were wading through it. Nehemiah 9:11, and you divided the sea before them so that they went through the midst of the sea on dry land, and their persecutors you threw into the deep as a stone into the mighty waters. We're not talking about any 3 feet deep wade through. Exodus 14:22, so the children of Egypt went into the midst of the sea on dry land, and the water was a wall to them on the right hand and on their left. Do you think they would have been impressed with the wall? Oh, maybe a little bit less high than this lectern here. That, boy, that's an impressive miracle there. How about that? It just doesn't fit. Now, perhaps some of you have seen some of these documentaries. Some of these documentaries where they, unfortunately, it's probably a civil engineer that was doing this, has a computer program and said, well, enough, this wind is blowing like this, and we can model it, and it's shallow, and there's some parts are not real shallow, and the wind blows, pushes it, and this land bridge appears, and they walk across the land bridge, and then, oh, the water's 3 feet of water is going to close and drown anybody. What Egyptian soldier would drown in 3 feet of water? Now, they, oh, it was not, it was a tsunami. Well, that's not the way water works, actually. And so it's saying here that it was deep. And so, the east wind. Now we have a wind blowing the other direction than from the locust. Blew the locust out. Now it's blowing from the east and blowing it in. And there's, we're somewhere up in this swampy area. These are shallow lakes, like I showed you before. But here's the thing. We in South Louisiana, we know wind and we know flooding. We know it. We know it well, and we know how it acts. Now, when I was chairman of the Department of Civil Engineering, I had a professor who for years was saying, if we ever get the big hurricane that comes in east of New Orleans and heads north, we're all going to die. Well, he didn't say that. But he said, New Orleans is going to drown. And sure enough, his prophecy was fulfilled. Katrina. It was a Category 5, 250 miles offshore. It died down some. I think it was a Category 2, or maybe even a Category 1 by the time it actually came ashore. But it was pushing this huge surge of water. Maybe 15 feet deep, this water surged across those low swampy lands, broke the levees and flooded New Orleans. The surge kept coming north across Lake Bourne, across the eastern end of Lake Pontchartrain, this massive wall of water. Now, if you don't believe me about how this water acts, ask Chris Lydia. She was there. She was in Slidell. I was talking to her. The storm, the wind had gone. The water was still coming. Because water moves slow. It's almost like molasses compared to wind. And she thought, hey, it's over. When water started coming into her house. In a matter of a few hours, she was scrambling up with her family and her elderly father into the attic. As the water just, no tsunami or anything, washed the house away. Just filled up. Was it a day and a half you were up there, Chris? 2 days. And then it just went down. Went a tsunami down. Just went down, flowed back where it belongs, to Pontchartrain, back into Lake Bourne. There was no, did you see any soldiers drowned? Yeah. That's not the way water works. So this whole idea, don't buy into it. It just doesn't fit in any way, shape, or form. You know, they want the miracle thing. You know, the miracles, they believe there's none, and everything can be explained naturally, as I said earlier, that they're caused by natural force, but it's the timing that's the miracle. Now, there are 28 miracles associated with Moses and Aaron during the Exodus. 28. They don't like to talk about those. And then there's things like the location of the wilderness. There's no wilderness up there. Exodus 13, verse 18, so God led the people around by the way of the wilderness of the Red Sea. Remember that phrase, wilderness of the Red Sea? That seems to be pointing towards the Gulf of Aqaba. And this is another thing. Yeah, I've got my map up there. This is another thing. Why would the children of Israel leave Egypt? What was their destination? Canaan. And head in the opposite direction. You think they might be saying, God, what about your compass? Canaan is that way. You're heading this way. Wouldn't it make a little more sense if maybe they headed over in the general direction of Canaan? Rather than they weren't going to head up along the Mediterranean Sea, because God didn't want them to do that. But why head down here? So that's another question. But and then look at how this same verse is translated in the new the NIV. So God led his people around by the desert road towards the Red Sea. And the Tanakh, the Hebrew translation, says, so God led the people round about by way of the wilderness at the Sea of Reeds. So they like this reeds thing in the Hebrew. All right, so I'm going to ask for a vote here. You've seen the evidence that I presented you. There's no evidence of a lake crossing, little evidence that the mountain of God was in Sinai. The route's not consistent with the Bible, little time for Pharaoh to organize his army, water depth so shallow they could walk across, and then they would be heading in the opposite direction from Canaan. All right. So, the question, the level of confidence, out of five, with five being, I am absolutely confident that this is the route. I'm going to take a vote. How many say level five? You know this is the route. How many say four? Three? Two? How many say one? There's no chance this is the route. Okay. Nobody's voting. Boy. Nobody voting? I'm going to have to talk to y'all. I may have to change the laws. Make you vote. Whether you have an identification or not. But I agree. A level of confidence of one is what I would give this. I don't think this is it. Now, very quickly here, let me finish up, because I'm not going to spend much time on this, because I've talked about a lot of the things associated with this route already, and that is that they cross at the mouth of the Gulf of Aqaba. Now, this means they were heading over into Midian to the mountain of God, first of all. Now, it is the longest route, but it makes a little more sense than one I just gave you. Let's zero in. They're going to cross here at the mouth of the Gulf of Aqaba, the Strait of Tinan, I think it's called. Let's zero in. So here they come around the Gulf of Aqaba. If they head back up now towards Canaan, they're blocked right here. Mountains come right down to the sea here. So they turn around. The Egyptian army comes up behind them. They cross here. That's the theory. And so it's true, they would be blocked and they would have to turn around and they would have to cross the Gulf of Aqaba at the mouth. And so they say, well, Pi-Hahiroth is there and Migdol is right around there and Beelzebub is there. And so they've located them all these here because nobody knows where they are. We'll just put them here because it fits our scheme. And then they cross there. About 12 miles, you know, give or take. But here's a cross-section of the seabed there. The seabed is, well, these are meters. So the seabed at its deepest point is about 800 feet deep. Plenty deep enough, but only for about a half a mile across here. And the rest of it's pretty shallow. And maybe it wasn't this deep 3,500 years ago. Who knows? All right, but there is a problem there if it was that deep. Let's bring up a chart here. I took some, scaled off some measurements. That steepest slope, this uphill slope right here, so it looks a little steeper. That's about a little over a 20-degree slope, which means over 10 feet, you got to climb 3¾ feet. Doable, but not easy. Okay? But so it's pretty steep. So that's a little bit of a problem here with them. All right, now we have all those other things we talked about. They're heading in the wrong direction, and so forth. You know, it is consistent with the mountain of God being in east of the Gulf of Aqaba, and it's consistent more with the Bible narrative being trapped. There is time for Pharaoh's army to come after them, get organized. The wilderness is nearer the crossing. Moderately deep water, but the Bible says it should be deep. But it's the longest route, so travel time becomes a little bit of a problem. I'm going to talk more about times next sermon. When you look, there are some benchmark times. And this one's they really needed to make the journey in about 14 days to fit other Bible things that I'll talk about next time. So that's a little bit of a problem. It's a little bit long. And that steep incline over the crossing. And, of course, they were heading the opposite direction, too. All right, so we'll take another vote. Maybe a few voters have registered since that last vote. So let's do it again. On this one, the level of confidence, how many of you would give this a five? Pretty sure thing. None? Four? Three? two. Got a vote. Was that a vote? Don't hear a vote. Give me. I need one more vote. One. And then we have the famous group that just don't care. So not voting. I gave it a 3. It could have been a 2. I mean, this would work. It kind of fits the Bible. But there's just enough things wrong with it that, no, I don't have just kind of middling confidence that this would possibly be the right one. That's it. I just don't see it. So we've looked at two of the crossings, and we've more or less said these don't look too good. We've shown you that we're not sure where the mountain is. It does kind of look like it's over on the other side of the Gulf of Aqaba. Next time, we'll look at two other crossings and kind of bring some of this to a conclusion, because there's lots of things to question yet, especially about the wind. Could the wind have blown the wall and held the water back? That we'll answer next time.